prided myself. I've been governor about 9 months now. I've prided myself by saying I've never had a bad day. Well, I can't say that anymore. This is a really tough day.
Governor Walker tours a neighborhood devastated by landslides in Sitka. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 19th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hellman. Also tonight, a survivor of the disaster describes his escape.
We heard a rumbling. It didn't immediately dawn on us what it was. We looked at each other with puzzled expressions, and then we looked at the hill and we saw these 200-foot trees falling like dominoes, boom, 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 one after another.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The UAS School of Management offers Bachelor of Business Administration degree programs online with an emphasis in human resources and management information systems. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Governor Bill Walker was in Sitka today to assess the damage from a series of landslides that hit the city after rains on Tuesday. He also met with the families of three people missing since Tuesday morning. Meanwhile, the search for the three men is proceeding slowly, hampered by fears of further landslides. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Governor Walker arrived in Sitka early Wednesday morning and flew over the affected areas in a Coast Guard helicopter. But he said it wasn't until he was standing on the edge of the Kramer Avenue landslide, where trees are stacked 15 feet high and there's a blank space on the hillside where a house used to be, that the scale of destruction came home to him.
I mean, the size of the logs, they showed me a picture of the house before. I mean, it was a substantial, significant size house that is just... You know, I mean, the devastation is just amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
Three men are missing and presumed dead after a river of mud and debris wiped out a house and much of the road on Kramer Avenue, a new neighborhood about 3 miles from downtown Sitka. Walker said it reminded him of the scene in Valdez after the 1964 earthquake and said he was overwhelmed.
I've prided myself. I've been governor about 9 months now. I've prided myself by saying I've never had a bad day. Well, I can't say that anymore. This is a really tough day, so...
Walker also met with the families of the missing men. All three were involved in construction in the neighborhood. William Stortz, age 62, is Sitka's building official. He was inspecting the site on Tuesday morning. Brothers Ulysses and Elmer Diaz, age 25 and 26, were working on one of the houses. Meeting with family and friends of the Diaz brothers at Sitka's Grace Harbor Church, Walker said he shares their frustration that search efforts aren't happening faster. The area around Kramer Avenue remains unstable, and search teams have been held up by concerns about more landslides. During a news conference with the governor at Sitka's fire hall, City Administrator Mark Gorman choked up as he spoke about the three missing men and about Sitka's response. Hundreds of Sitkans have signed up to volunteer in the search or have dropped off food for the responders and for families evacuated from their homes.
And what I found in the last 24 hours is heart-wrenching, and it's about community. William is a friend of many years, family and colleague. Diaz boys grew up with my sons, and this is what this is about today. It's about hurt and caring in our community. And I extend my sympathy to all the families and neighbors and friends. We are hurting collectively today.
Gorman was echoed by Fire Chief Dave Miller. Miller said he's worked with the Sitka Fire Department for about 28 years.
And I think yesterday was one of the hardest days of my life. And I had to talk to those family members and say, I am so sorry. First for what happened, and then that we're not allowing those teams to go in and start looking for your family members. The thing that we have to worry about is the safety of all the others too. The safety of the people that are going in there and do that, and look for their members.
Meanwhile, Sitka Mayor Mim McConnell said she's not ready to give up hope.
And that's the important thing that I think a lot of us need to keep in mind, is that miracles do happen. And there's family members and friends that are hanging on to that, and I support that. You just never know. So we're hopeful. And I'm going to stay that way until it doesn't make sense to be that way.
Sitka has requested that the governor declare a state of emergency, which would open up access to state funds. Walker said the request is his staff's top priority and would be answered as soon as possible. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
As crews continue to cautiously work through debris searching for the three victims of the landslide, it's clear that the event could have been much worse. There are many homes below and on either side of the slide, and there were two other people directly in its path who escaped. KCIW's Robert Woolsey visited the slide zone today to meet with a survivor.
It's not raining at the moment in Sitka, at least not down here close to sea level. But the amount of water running through the Kramer Avenue slide suggests that the heavy clouds overhead are again saturating the slopes of Harbor Mountain. City engineer David Longton is working with some tree fallers and a track hoe to divert water away from the recovery area.
So, and it's going to start raining again, you know, and when it does start raining, we don't want more water to go in there. We want it to be in the ditch where it should be.
Longton has been here almost continuously since the hillside above Kramer broke loose Tuesday morning at 9:30. He had accompanied city building official William Stortz to the site to inspect the drainage in this brand new subdivision after the extraordinarily heavy rainfall earlier in the day. Longton and Stortz were standing in the drive complimenting the work of a third man, excavator Jerome Mahusky, when the slide started.
We heard a rumbling. Didn't immediately dawn on us what it was. We looked at each other with puzzled expressions, and then we looked up the hill and we saw these 200-foot trees falling like dominoes, boom, 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 one after another.
Although the slide was still far up the mountain, Longton says it was moving fast. The subdivision was tucked into a small ravine, and it was clear that the slide could turn and head their way. That's when they started running.
Of the three of us, William was the furthest uphill, but just still within 5 feet of us. So Jerome was next to me as we started sprinting down the hill. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw William, behind me, with a concerned look on his face, and we just started running. And I was aware of Jerome being next to me the whole time we were running, not aware of William. I think I would have been aware of him, even though he was behind us. He's 61 or 62, but he's very fit, very nimble, you know. So then we ran down the access road, got into Kramer. Started running down Kramer, and I decided to run up on this embankment, this 30-foot high pile of gravel, to try to stay above it all. Jerome decided to stay out on the road, and you can see where the slide stopped, so Jerome was able to run past here before the slide got here. And from the time we started running till the time we got up there was probably 10 or 12 seconds, no more than that, and no sign of William.
The search is still underway for Stortz's body and those of two other victims, brother Elmer and Ulysses Diaz, who were working in a house in the path of the slide.
Yeah, I'll bring it up there and grab a sandwich on my way out.
Longton doesn't talk about whether or not he is lucky. He and many other city workers and volunteers are just too busy addressing the aftermath. But he brings an engineer's perspective to the event and how he survived it. Once the slide reached Kramer Avenue, it was a mass of mud and interlocking trees, and it was slowing down.
It was a solid, but it was acting like liquid. It was flowing. You know, imagine mayonnaise, maybe not quite that viscous, but kind of like mayonnaise. So I was running as fast as I could downhill. It wasn't nipping at our heels, but it wasn't lingering too far behind either.
The slide came to a halt about 100 feet above where it is now. Longton says that there was no sign of William Stortz. He and Mahusky went back up the slope to try and find Mahusky's truck, which had his two dogs inside. The slide pushed downhill twice more, about 50 feet each time. Then Longton called 911 and began the work that he has been doing more or less ever since. Having been in harm's way, this engineer is not too anxious about remaining there.
You know, there's a lot of potential energy up there before it released, but now it's been released, so I think things have kind of reached an equilibrium more or less, so I'm keeping my eye on it, don't be wrong, but I don't feel that nervous being here.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the National Park Service funds a new tribal house in Glacier Bay.
You know, the Park Service represents the stories of our nation, and it seems like some of the native stories have been missing from some parks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their business and counseling psychology undergraduate programs. APU offers affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support personal and professional goals. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
A man with a long history in drug enforcement will be Anchorage's new police chief. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the city administration says he'll be in step with a plan to develop a community policing model.
Chris Tolley will take over as Anchorage Chief of Police when current Chief Mark Muse steps down in mid-October. Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz made the announcement at City Hall on Wednesday. Tolley has spent the past 28 years as a special agent for the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, the last four of them based in Anchorage. He will begin his stint as a city employee as acting deputy chief at APD on September 1st. Berkowitz said by way of introducing Tolley that the deputy job helps ensure a smooth transition.
His experience, not just around the world and across the country, but here in Anchorage, gives him the ability to understand what we do with APD and the ways that we can move forward. At the same time, because he's not directly from the APD family, he's going to bring a fresh perspective.
Tolley began his law enforcement career as a beat cop in Baltimore 36 years ago. His experience since then exposed him to many aspects of police work. With DEA, he worked both in the United States and abroad. Tolley says his background in partnering with domestic and foreign law enforcement will help the APD move in new directions.
And crime has no boundaries. It is no longer confined to a single city. With the internet, social media, and global travel, law enforcement must extend to one another, local, state, federal, and international. Our municipality faces many challenges. The homeless, drug addiction, and violence all influence from outside our jurisdiction.
Tolley's DEA experience took him to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and to Hawaii, where he worked to eradicate marijuana. He has also worked as an undercover agent combating drug transportation and has a background with the DEA's Los Angeles office as a manager and personnel trainer. Current APD Chief Mark Mue will step down on October 12th to pursue new opportunities with the Bering Straits Native Corporation. Mue has high praise for Tolley.
I think this is a great choice for the next step for the Anchorage Police Department. I worked with Chris for probably 4 years now, I think, on a lot of different projects, and I know his skill level and his depth of character. And I think he's going to be an excellent choice to lead the Anchorage Police Department moving forward.
Berkowitz thanked Mue for his 5 years of service, saying that during Mue's tenure, the department wrestled with a lack of staffing.
I also want to take this occasion to thank Chief Mue for exemplary service under what has been difficult and trying times.
The city is working to prepare a budget that will train and put more officers on the street, Berkowitz said. The mayor and Tolley emphasized that a new philosophy of policing is evolving as well. Tolley says community policing begins with dialogue with community figures.
Policing has changed very much since the days I began, where you just take control of a situation and you take action swiftly. Today, it's so important to give everyone a voice. And I want to take the time to try to listen to them, make sure our officers are trained to do just that.
He says he wants the force to reflect the city's diversity. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
An Anchorage teen who pleaded guilty to hitting and killing a man on a bicycle will be sentenced to 3 years in prison with two suspended. Judge Michael Wolverton accepted the plea deal agreed to earlier this year. Alexandra Ellis was 17 when she struck 51-year-old Jeff Dusenberry with her pickup on an Anchorage neighborhood street. Despite arguments by the defense that she'll be treated as a juvenile, she will serve time as an adult. The sentencing hearing began on Friday and primarily focused on the scene of the accident and how fast the vehicle and bicycle were traveling. Today's testimony focused on Ellis's ability to overcome her alcohol and substance abuse problems. Her substance abuse counselor said Ellis seemed fully committed to her treatment. Before the accident, she had spent 9 months in a residential treatment facility as well. But as Ellis sobbed in the background, her father, Maurice Ellis, said she had changed since that day last July.
I would say undoubtedly, but without a question in my mind, Jeff Dusenberry has saved my daughter. That's the only way that I'm able to rationalize this whole thing, is that he saved my daughter. That my daughter has a chance at a healthy, happy life because of him.
Before the final sentencing, Alice herself addressed the court and apologized to Dusenberry's family.
And I'd like to end with saying that I will spend the rest of my life trying to be the best version of the self that I can. I'm very sorry for how I've hurt you and that I've taken away your dad. I'm so sorry. And it will never be enough to just say it.
In making his final decision, Judge Wolverton said the situation was sad for everyone involved, but he had no legal basis for rejecting the plea deal. He assured the public that the probation system works, and if a person breaks the conditions of probation, they will face consequences. He then addressed Ellis directly.
If you don't make those lifelong, permanent changes, none of this will have made any sense whatsoever. None of it. I think you can do that. I'm convinced, based upon what's been presented to me, that you can do that.
Both sides declined to comment on the outcome. Ellis will start serving her one-year jail term on October 24th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A prototype in-river hydropower system is currently in operation in Igiagik in southwest Alaska. It's part of a recent surge of research that's pushed the technology closer to becoming a reality for rural communities seeking an alternative to diesel power. From KIYU in Galena, Tim Bedoni has more.
In-river hydropower does not rely on dams. Instead, it captures the free-flowing energy of a river to spin a turbine and create electricity, like a windmill for the water. But prior tests of small in-river hydro units at Ruby and Eagle on the Yukon River have not gone so well due to interference caused by driftwood. Unlike the design tested at Ruby and Eagle, which was suspended just under the surface of the water by a small pontoon platform, the prototype in use at Igiagig right now sits on the river bottom. It's much wider than it is tall and looks like an old-fashioned push lawnmower rather than a typical windmill or table fan shape. The prototype is called the RivGen, and it was designed by Ocean Renewable Power Company, which is based in Maine but has an office and several projects underway in Alaska. Monty Worthington is ORPC's Director of Project Development. Having a hydropower system sitting on the bottom of a river, Worthington says, has several advantages. It works quietly and out of sight, but more importantly,
gets us down below the floating debris in a river, and that can be wood, that could be ice in some cases, but anything that's floating on the surface of the river, we are no longer in the way of, and it also includes impeding navigation in certain areas, so we can be down at a depth where boats are still able to pass freely over the device.
The RivGen test site on the Quijack River at Igiagig is clear and mostly free of debris, not an ideal place to test the turbine's ability to deal with driftwood and silt. But the clear water does give researchers a better chance to watch how the blades impact fish, another important environmental consideration that hydropower designers must deal with. At a test site on the Tanana River at Nenana, researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Center for Energy and Power are putting some different in-river hydro designs through their paces in a more challenging environment, including lots of driftwood and silt. The most recent design to be tested comes from Oceana Power Company. It's suspended just under the surface from a barge and looks like a ring with shark fins embedded around it. According to Alaska Hydrokinetic Research Center Program Director Jeremy Casper, the Oceana system worked without a problem for a month last fall and a month earlier this summer. The Oceana unit was protected by a UAF-designed debris diverter placed just upstream, which Casper says was highly effective.
The debris diverter is kind of a V, and we can adjust the angle. And at the tip of V, there's a cylinder that rotates. And when the debris hits that cylinder, the debris starts to rotate it and then slides off down the sides.
Future research is going to look at the potential problems caused by subsurface debris, like waterlogged trees and root balls that bounce along the bottom of a river. When silty water does not allow for video cameras to get a look at what's going on, Casper says the researchers will rely on sonar.
The other thing that we're going to be doing in conjunction with the sonar is having a mechanical means of detecting debris. Basically, we're going to put down a grate down towards the bottom and see if we can get some simultaneous impact measurements along with the sonar. So then we'll know what the sonar is seeing and what the impact forces are.
As more of the engineering hurdles are crossed, Casper predicts that in another 5 years, in-river hydropower systems will be ready for widespread use across Alaska.
I'm hoping we start seeing and start convincing the Department of Energy that they really need to fund these pilot projects in places like Alaska. And I think what we'll probably see in the next few years is a few communities, Igiagig is almost there, adapting these technologies with partnerships, basically, between the developer and the community.
Regardless of the technical advances with in-river hydropower systems, no one thinks they can survive spring breakup, so they're all being designed to be removed from the water in the fall or winter before the ice goes out. In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
A $3 million Tlingit tribal house is being constructed on the shores of Bartlett Cove in Glacier Bay, likely the first time the National Park Service has funded a tribal house. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins stopped by a Huna carving shed where the totems are being shaped.
Three carvers are chipping away on an eagle moiety pole that'll go outside the red cedar tribal house. The crest of a wolf, porpoise, brown bear, and thunderbird are starting to form, representing the clans in the area. The lead carver is Gordon Greenwald. He says it takes over a month to get this far on the totem, and it'll likely be six more before it's finished.
No, we could complete it faster than that if we use some machines, chainsaws and so forth, to do some of the major cutting. But we've chosen not to do it that way. We're trying to do it all by hand.
His team has been carving the pieces to go in the Huna tribal house for about 5 years. There's a constant flood of cruise ship tourists in and out of the shed, asking questions and marveling over the handiwork. But Greenwald says he doesn't mind.
For people that are new to this area, it gives them a chance to learn about our people, going away knowing that they're Tlingit people that live here and what our life was like. And for our local people, they get to stop in and see that something is being made that represents themselves in our homeland.
An interior and exterior screen is already complete. So are the house posts of the four clans that identify Glacier Bay as home: Wushkiton, Chukanadi, Kagwantan, and Takdaintan.
So they are an inextricable part of the story of Glacier Bay, but there's really no physical sign of their history here, unfortunately.
That's Tom Vandenberg, the chief of interpretation at Glacier Bay National Park. Bartlett Cove is the site of the new tribal house. It's where the clans originally resided, until an encroaching glacier forced them to relocate hundreds of years ago to what's now called Huna. In 1925, Glacier Bay became a national monument, and federal laws limited what the Huna Tlingit could do in their homeland.
It's difficult. You know, the Park Service represents the stories of our nation, and it seems like some of the native stories have been missing from some parks.
He says there are places like Sitka National Historic Park with Southeast Native totems. But overall,
there's not much in the way of Alaskan Native stories being told in parks.
The National Park Service received a request from the Hoona Indian Association back in 1992 to build the tribal house. Vandenberg is unaware of anything else like it, a ceremonial house paid for by concessionaires' fees from businesses that operate within Glacier Bay. Tlingit Elder and Park Management Assistant Ken Grant says it's going to be an emotional day when the tribal house is finished.
People really have a strong tie to the homeland. You know, that feeling of being left out has been with our elders for a long time. Like they say in our language, you know, they were buried with their sorrow in their hearts.
He hopes it'll be a space for young Hoona Tlingits to learn about their roots and enhance language and cultural preservation.
It's taken a long time for us to really see this come to fruition.
Gordon Greenwald again.
Now that I look back on it, I'm wondering why it hadn't happened in all the other parks long ago.
Owen James and Herb Shakely are singing a song about one of the Hoona clans. When Shakely started this project 5 years ago, he says he didn't know all the stories, and he didn't know how to carve. He's been practicing at home, making ceremonial hats out of spruce, and working on the eagle pole. Greenwald says he owes teaching to his mentors, passing on the knowledge so it doesn't stop with him.
On all of this work, none of us will sign it, because none of this work is about us. As individuals, it's about our people.
The Hoona Tribal House is expected to be dedicated next August. In Hoona, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Results from Alaska's new standardized test show that fewer students are proficient in math and reading than previous tests indicated. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports the students took the Alaska Measures of Progress for the first time this past spring. The results show less than one-third of Alaska's public school students in grades 3 through 10 are proficient in math. The older standards-based assessment results showed about two-thirds of the students were proficient in 2013 to 2014. The English and Language Arts assessment the new test indicated one-third of students were proficient. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholt and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tim Madoni in Galena, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.